This is Bonjour Chai, the Students Doth Protest Too Much edition. I am Avi Feingold. I'm here with Phoebe Maltzbovi and special guest Gabby Deutsch. We are your frozen chosen. On today's show, we talk about all the cover stories and coverage of anti-Semitism in the media, whether America is becoming more like Europe. And don't worry, there is a lot more great news at the end of it. We talk about the joy of Judaism and how good we can and should be thinking about things. All that and more coming up right after this. Phoebe, we have a special guest host with us today, somebody who has been on our radar for quite a while, Gabby Deutsch. Gabby, you work at Jewish Insider. Tell us about yourself. Tell us about what Jewish Insider actually is.
Absolutely. Well, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I live in Boston, but I should just start by noting that I was born in Ohio, and that's where a lot of my family is. So as a person from a very nice state, I feel a kinship to Canada in that respect. But I grew up in Florida. And to answer your question, I am a journalist at Jewish Insider. We're a Jewish news site based in Washington, D.C., and we cover primarily politics, but from a Jewish angle. So looking at how the things we all care about, anti-Semitism, Israel, much more play out among the American political system. So I cover the White House and the State Department and political campaigns, and lately also anti-Semitism and college campuses and a lot of depressing, but I think important things.
So is Jewish Insider new? Because I don't remember hearing about it until fairly recently, but it could just be a me thing.
Yeah. So Jewish Insider, I've been here for about 3 years. I'm not sure exactly how old JI is, but definitely relatively new in the scheme of Jewish publications. We started as purely an email newsletter that was aggregating the Jewish news of the day, sort of a Jewish Politico playbook, if that means anything to folks in Canada. And so now the main way that we reach people is still with an email newsletter in the morning. And we try to be the place that people who care about these issues in our community, whether Jewish or not, come to get a sense of the key stories, the conversations happening in the community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I saw that put you on my radar as well, especially for today, is that you used to work at this thing called NewsGuard, which was some sort of a startup fighting misinformation, teaching news literacy, which is exactly the type of thing that we wanted to get into today, because I feel like that is something that is sorely missing, not just within the general population, but specifically within the Jewish community. And that's so much of the locus of the discussion that I'm sure we're about to have is around the idea of misinformation and how to actually absorb the news, how to consume news in a responsible manner.
Before this, I was working, as you said, at this company called NewsGuard, and we essentially provided ratings of news sites to news consumers. And instead of fact-checking articles to say, this is true, this isn't, we would provide context on different sources. And we tried to do it in a way that would help people make sense of what they were reading and essentially decide for themselves whether it was a trusted source or not. So we tried to put that information into their hands instead of completely shutting down an article or saying, this is bad, don't read it. And we did a lot of work around news literacy. We worked with libraries and educators and schools and did a lot of research as well on misinformation trends. I worked there all throughout 2020, which was a good time for the misinformation business, if you will, in that we had COVID and the 2020 election in the US and all of the fake fraud claims. So we did a lot of research on that and tracking where some of those falsehoods were coming from. And it was fascinating and gratifying work at that time, but also very challenging. I spent my days in the deep recesses of the internet that I hope you never have to experience.
Oh, I voluntarily subject myself to many deep recesses of the internet, but that is not our subject for today. Today we're going to talk about So there have been all of these big cover stories really everywhere. So there's been The Atlantic, there's been Time Magazine, there's been The Evening Standard in the UK, all about anti-Semitism, unprecedented anti-Semitism, which has been a topic, I should say, on our show since before October 7th, because really, I would say since Trump was elected, there has been discussion of the unprecedented anti-Semitism. But then also even beyond the English-speaking world, there's been Le Monde covering anti-Semitism in Montreal. There's been just this sense you get from the mainstream media that anti-Semitism is terrible and is happening via things to do with the Israel-Gaza war, that that is the reason at the moment that things are different. I guess one thing we're going to want to talk about is just what the protests specifically are. But first, have you noticed all of these cover stories and what do you make of this phenomenon?
I have noticed the cover stories. I have read the cover stories. One thing that struck me when this week reading the Atlantic's news story about the headline, I think, was "The Golden Age of Jewish Life in America is Over," something like that. Not a question, a declarative statement, which is obviously very troubling. And as I was reading that, one of the first things I thought of was a previous cover story in The Atlantic by Jeff Goldberg, "Is It Time for the Jews to Leave Europe?" So I looked that up, and that was published almost 10 years ago. And so I think having those, it's sort of a striking bookend to Trump coming, obviously, in 2016 and everything that has happened since then and since October 7th of last year. And the argument wasn't made in this new Atlantic piece that American Jews need to leave. But certainly a lot of those trends that when we, or at least I remember reading that Atlantic story 10 years ago and thinking, that's so bad in Europe. I can't believe how much security they need. I can't believe that they're tucking their Jewish star into their shirt. And we're so lucky in America, that's not going to happen here. And it's not that things have become exactly that, but certainly some of that has come over to North America as well. And I think it's important to be talking about and having these stories that put it in a bigger context beyond just the day-to-day. It's easy to get lost in the minutiae of this protest and that protest, and there's a million things all the time and a million, you know, anti-Semitic incidents, some more serious than others. But to step back and have it in the historical context, it didn't just start on October 7th. It's not just what's coming from the situation in Israel. It's troubling, but important to talk mm-hmm. about.
Yeah, I mean, a couple things jumped out at me here. And one is in Franklin Forer's article, that's the new one in The Atlantic, he has some line about, like, everything started to change with 9/11, but we didn't know it then. And I mean, that was right when I started college. And I kind of think I did know it then. Not that I'm some sort of prophet, but, like, I remember a certain amount of casual anti-Semitism to do with Israel in 2001. So at the University of Chicago. So I think what changes is maybe level or whatever. But yeah, so some of these things are pretty old. But the other thing that I was thinking about was just how existential it all is. And I'm thinking about, like, so this article in the Evening Standard, it very much is like, can Jews stay in London? Can Jews stay in England? Can Jews stay, you know? And it ends with somebody, one of the people interviewed for it, I guess, it ends with him moving to Israel, which is interesting, I think, just in light of the fact that these protests are all ostensibly anti-Israel. Do they actually...
So I actually saw two conflicting things happening around 2001, which was, as a student at Concordia University in Montreal, yes, it was around then was the rise of the Second Intifada. There was a lot of anti-Israel sentiment in the air in very specific pockets of, you know, of the left. But 9/11, I felt, was the thing that woke up America to America's, like, anti-Arabism. As a result, there was this bump of sentiment towards the Jewish community because of Israel, right? That if Israel was the democracy in the Middle East and the one fighting the good fight against the people that are now our enemies, there was this wave of, like, positive sentiment towards the Jewish community because of 9/11, I found, outside of this really small, you know, Palestinian human rights, you know, activist space. The rest of it was really, really opposite. So I actually got very confused about
that. Yeah, I mean, I think it depends... When I would encounter this in college, I'm telling you, these were not, like, far left student radical types. This was just people who probably baseline had never liked Jews and now had a new reason to talk about it.
What I thought was fascinating about the 9/11 point, and cards on the table, my historical memory doesn't extend back that far. but he talked about how 9/11 was really not the first time that there was an Israel-related conspiracy theory, but the first time that it had staying power and in that there was this narrative that Israel orchestrated 9/11. Certainly it's something we still hear today and see on Twitter, but that narrative hadn't quite struck through to the mainstream before when it comes to Israel and the way that that planted the seeds for some of the narratives we see today around Israel. The fact that you had that and it wasn't immediately pushed, you know, far to the corners. Certainly it's not mainstream, but it's 23 years later, and that's very much still, unfortunately, part of the horrible online conversations.
Well, what's so fascinating to me, and I'm so glad you brought up the Jeffrey Goldberg article, because I think what I've seen with my historical memory being what it is, so I'm 40, I studied French Jews in grad school, so I was very up on like European Jewish things at the time, a little less so these days. It seems like what you see now in North America is what you would have seen in France in the past. Like this whole, is it anti-Israel or is it anti-Jews? Can you even draw a distinction type of topic comes up a lot more in a different and more day-to-day and more sort of actually on the streets way than it used to. It used to be people maybe arguing a bit about ideas in North America, but now you have like, for example, just to put it sort of in more concrete terms, like if you're protesting a Jewish deli, if you're protesting a falafel place because its owner is Israeli and did they culturally appropriate the hummus or whatever, that in North America strikes me as maybe new.
I think it's new, the extent to which it's happening. I mean, this sounds naive now, but I remember waking up on October 7th and reading the news and obviously being horrified by it and thinking, this is, you know, and there was no Israeli response yet. It was just the pure evil and horrors that were happening that day. And I remember reading about it and thinking, maybe this is the thing that's so awful that everyone will believe it, will, I don't want to say support evil, I think, or support Israel, excuse me. I think that's not quite accurate, but just that there would be sympathy extended to the Jewish people toward Israel in a way we haven't always seen. Then we saw, I don't know if it was October 7th or early on the 8th, this statement from several dozen student groups at Harvard essentially blaming Israel for the entire massacre of Israelis by Hamas. And that to me was deeply surprising and I think new, especially for a place like Harvard, and has set the tone for so much of what we've seen these past 5 months.
I had a very, very similar thought when Trump got elected or when Trump had this or when Trump had that. I was like, what's the moment when X group that I think is completely horribly deluded about something, is this the moment that's going to wake them up to the fact that like, oh, you know, I'm waking up out of a fever dream. There's a huge problem. What's going on here? Is this the moment? Was that the moment? Is October 7th was going to be the moment? I was like, nope, you know what? There are no more moments like that. People that think a certain way will always spin whatever it is to whatever ideology that they currently hold, and we leave it at that.
I was just going to say, like, so we're going to talk just a bit about, like, we're talking about the coverage of protests, but I wanted to just talk about what the protests themselves are, because I'm having trouble sort of sorting this out, like, what they seek to accomplish, because I think it seems clear to me, and I say this as a Zionist, that there is a humanitarian crisis in Gaza, and that it's upsetting. The news from there is upsetting, and you can equivocate about, oh, but there's upsetting news from all over the world. Why does one hear so much about this? Whatever. But the point is, it is upsetting. It is upsetting news. And I think a lot of people would like to see this not be the case anymore. What are the protests is what I'm trying to make sense of. And I guess, obviously, that's a kind of huge question because it depends which. But like, when people on a university campus are protesting, what are the objectives, do you think?
I think that is the question. And unfortunately, I don't think I will be able to answer it, but I can try. You see these videos from all kinds of campuses. Someone sent me a video from the business school at the University of Michigan recently of at least 100 people, maybe more, walking through the business school, this big, beautiful, modern building, chanting "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." And I think the question of what those protesters want, there's the policy question, you know, are they doing this to get the university to divest from companies that operate in Israel? That might be part of it, but I think often we're not seeing something so specific in terms of what they're asking for. Certainly in some cases there is more of that, but often it's more, I think, just aligning with that movement. And then aside from that more direct question about the school they're at or the city they're in, I think zoom out and look at some of the language around "from the river to the sea, globalize the intifada." And the question that I continue to have, and that I don't really know how a lot of those folks would answer, is what's your end goal here? Is it an end to this war? Is it certainly that's something that, as you were saying, makes sense for a lot of people, given the scenes that we're seeing out of Gaza. But is it just an end to the war? Is it a two-state solution? It doesn't really seem that way, given the language. Or is it, we don't want Israel at all? And I think a lot of people are saying that outright. I don't know necessarily why they're doing those protests on campuses, or I got an email this morning, a press release about a protest that's going to shut down one of the major freeways in Los Angeles this morning at the morning commute, which certainly I someone who has spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, that's not going to win people over to their cause in a place where people love to complain about traffic. So I think it more shows this growing and sentiment. I think a lot of people who follow this issue on campuses questioned whether after winter break and students came back in January, would that same energy from the fall be there? And it seemed a little iffy, but now very much, you know, those protests seem to be continuing. So I don't think that there is a concrete goal, but I do think in this sort of public show of aligning with the Palestinians, it's making clear that the politics are shifting. And I'll just say one more example. I was on Instagram last night and I follow the account for March for Our Lives, which is this grassroots gun violence prevention group in the US that was started in 2018 after the school shooting in South Florida. And I've been following the group. I grew up near there. You know, I had friends who went to that school. And when they started, they were this incredible grassroots entity. They organized hundreds of marches against gun violence all around the United States. And they last night announced their new platform, if you will. And it was end gun violence, stop climate change, immigration reform, and ceasefire. For an organization that has no other interest in foreign affairs. So just looking at the reach of the protests, how much are they actually accomplishing for Palestinians and for the situation in Gaza? I think probably very little, but in terms of shifting the political discourse in the US, that's very much happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think it often just seems very blurry to me what's sort of war is bad, war should stop, which is a kind of generic sentiment that I think, I don't want to say everybody shares, but it's, you don't have to have any particular politics to think war seems bad and should stop. But also then I think of like a video I saw from Montreal where somebody at what seemed to be a protest was shouting that Jews are settlers anywhere they live, whether it's Europe or, you know, or Israel, whatever. And then it just sort of seems like these two, you can't assume that everybody who is there to protest a humanitarian crisis and to end a war wants all Jews dead. You also do have the people who want all Jews dead. And you also have this sort of open question of like, where I just keep going. And I realize I'm probably straying too far from the topic, but I was just going to say that I think, like, I just keep wondering, like, okay, what if you say to the protesters, you win, here you go, you get what you want. What is it? What happens then?
Well, I think what you're pointing out is that there is no movement, right? The same way that there, that
there's
at the end of the day,
coherent movement, but yeah, there is a movement.
Sure. At the end of the day, there was a coherent movement, quote unquote, about Black Lives Matter, but everybody realizes that it was way bigger than that, as was the Women's March, as is now, you know, Gaza, as is climate change. Everybody, you know, you can't go and say, well, you're not authorized to protest on behalf of climate change, right? So we're not going to give you the license to do that. Everybody can do whatever they want. And the, you know, for the Palestinian cause, for example, for the ceasefire, the upshot for them, the great thing is that you find groups that are very far afield that are going to go and say, yes, end gun violence and the occupation, all of this comes together, right? The downside to that, which is what I'm seeing from within the Jewish community, is that anything, what this has seems to become from many, many members of the established, you know, mainstream Jewish community, is that as soon as you hear something that has to do with Palestine, there is nothing that you can possibly say that isn't going to mean that that's not anti-Semitic, right? Asking for a ceasefire, right? Even though I hate Hamas, I want all of the hostages back, but I want a ceasefire, right? You're an anti-Semite. I actually want to end gun violence. Oh, those gun violence people, they're for the occupation, right? They're for ending the occupation. You're an anti-Semite, right? This has become blurred. And I know, Phoebe, you have mentioned this in terms of the constellation of ideas that we have. And you've pointed out how anti-vaxxers and, you know, and come along with certain causes, right? And that we've really created these families of ideologies that all come together. Right now, the downside for this cause is, yes, they're getting a lot of coverage, but the downside, at least...
I don't, Avi, just to interrupt you, sorry, but like to clarify, the thing that I've talked about is how being very, very cautious about COVID has come to be associated with certain positions in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Yeah. Not sorry, COVID, not vaxxing. Sorry.
Anti-vaxxers
sorry,
yes. are their own interesting question, but I have no particular theory anyways, about them.
Sorry. Okay. I will... you know, I don't even know what to make of that. And I don't know how to go back to the Jewish community and say, you know what, there's nuance here. There are people that are genuinely, you know, not to say that they're anti-Zionist. There are people that love Israel, that are Zionist, that want a ceasefire. And yet they're being labeled as anti-Semites because they are on the wrong side of this ideology, which is all war all the time until we complete everything.
I have two responses to that. First,
I threw a lot out there. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I think what makes that very challenging for people who describe themselves as Zionist or pro-Israel or what have you, is that these ceasefire protests and these anti-Israel protests, which are not always the same, but often they are, have been going on since October 8th. And I think from people I've spoken to and as I observe this as well, for people who witnessed those protests on October 8th, some of which veered into outright celebration of the October 7th attacks, and others saying immediately from the beginning, Israel has no right to respond, don't even think about it. I think that made it so that even now, 5 months later, as the folks who are calling for a ceasefire certainly have grown to include people within the Jewish community, including some who are Zionists. Certainly there are some people who don't like the calls for ceasefire at all, but it's also that if you're calling for a ceasefire, in some ways you're aligning yourselves with those people who may have hung up those posters of the, you know, terrorists that parachuted into the music festival. And that's broadly speaking one movement. Of course, there's gradations within that, but I think for some of the people in the Jewish community who would say, you know, calling for a ceasefire is anti-Semitic, they just see all of those people in one bucket, for better or for worse.
So something that I see a lot, so Avi and I, as has probably come through, come from very different worlds, because what I see a lot of is people sort of in academia or in writing saying things like, how can you care about anti-Semitism and Jews' little feelings at a time when there are children starving in Gaza? How can you do that? And I guess where I end up sort of landing on this is that it's not that if Amy Schumer was offended by something on Instagram, that that's as bad as being bombed. That's not the issue. It's that, first of all, there was October 7th, which was not, you know, trivial. But also, I guess what I just wonder is is being kind of like blasé about day-to-day anti-Semitism in the diaspora, where does that lead the typical Jew on Zionism? And I'll tell you where it leads me. Like, it does not, like, I don't know. I don't think that if you want to, I guess strategically, it doesn't seem helpful to me, to Palestinians, to actual Palestinian people, for there to be a very anti-Semitic environment in the diaspora. I don't think that that, I mean, like, I think about why are French Jews so much more pro-Israel than American Jews or Canadian Jews generally, as I understand it. I don't know. I mean, there are complicated reasons to do with demography, but I think some of it has to do with if you feel under attack or not at home.
I think it's a great point, and also goes to what I was saying about the nature of these coalitions, if you will, in the protests, that you might be someone who is very involved in the Jewish community, feels very connected to your synagogue or whatever other community institution, and you might be starting to feel like you don't like what's happening in Gaza. Israel has made its point. It's time. But I think for some of those people, they look at these protest movements and, as you said, don't see much distinction between Jews and Zionists and Israelis, and you know, might think about joining those protests until they see some of the rhetoric that's employed there. And then they might think, you know what, I'm going to stay in my synagogue. I support Israel. October 7th was obviously horrible. And, you know, I think this environment where anti-Semitism is tolerated, to say the least, definitely does push Jews who are broadly pro-Israel from thinking about aligning with those causes, certainly from broadening their coalitions.
So we are people that are basically our daily lives is the Jewish media and reporting what's going on. One of the things that we've been struggling, you know, within the CJN, and I'm sure at Jewish Insider this comes up as well, is there's this tension between wanting to report what's been going on every week, you know, wherever one is in terms of protests and stuff like that, but also the realization that every week cannot possibly be the worst week for anti-Semitism ever. This is the worst that's ever happened. We have to breathlessly report everything that goes on every moment for the community, even though sometimes there's this sense that maybe it's being counterproductive, especially towards feeding the Jewish community something that is healthy and more nurturing and being able to be good about what one is consuming and how one is, you know, we're the ones doling it out. How do we dole it out in a more responsible manner when protests are not going to stop happening? But we also realize that this endless cycle of hype over hype over hype about what anti-Semitism is and how it's working and what's going on can't possibly be healthy.
It is a constant struggle because you're right. Those are the stories that we report. I try, at least in my work, if I am writing about something that happened, let's say on a campus or at a particular city council meeting, I'm trying to describe the facts as a journalist of what happened. You know, I'm not saying this is the worst thing that's ever happened. Obviously, there are people who will read it and will draw that conclusion. But I do think that this is, you were talking before about this language about unprecedented anti-Semitism that we've been hearing since 2016. Unfortunately, I'm going to use that language. I do think that what we've seen since October 7th is unprecedented. It's connected to the anti-Semitism that we saw in the Trump administration, but not the same. You know, certainly grew out of that and has some connections. And I think at this moment, as the war goes on, as things are so heated, attention absolutely deserves to be paid to covering these things and alerting folks in the community. At the same time, I also try to, where possible, find stories that are not totally depressing. I have not been succeeding very much at that lately. I will say, last week I was in Houston in Texas visiting my brother who is in graduate school there. And we went out to dinner at this Israeli restaurant in Houston called Hamsa, which is an award-winning restaurant with like some local celebrity Israeli chef. Not at all the kind of place I would have expected to find in Houston. And We went, we had an amazing dinner. They were playing country music the whole time. And so I'm hoping to do a story, you know, interviewing the chef and the Israeli owners of that restaurant, just to provide a little bit of a counterpoint at here's something interesting and exciting happening in the Jewish world. And even though anti-Semitism is bad, there are a lot of exciting things happening, you know, if you're Jewish right now.
I mean, I was just going to say to clarify about like the unprecedented anti-Semitism. I mean, if you had asked me on October 6th, I would have said, it's all a bit silly. We are not living in times of unprecedented anti-Semitism. There has been anti-Semitism. There always will be. It's not unprecedented. But I do think we are currently not unprecedented in terms of like Nazi Germany, obviously. But I think something has changed for sure. And but in terms of the Houston thing, I'm just thinking about like whether, and this comes up, this is going to seem a little out there, but bear with me. And this brings it back to Canada, Avi. So just something that I've noticed and written about a little bit is the way that like coffee shops, left wing coffee shops, like the independent coffee shops are like have a certain stance on Palestine, and then maybe like the sort of chain ones. But I'm wondering if there's a kind of blue America, red America split that's going to happen where Israeli restaurants would be less welcome in maybe a more deep blue pocket. I don't know. That's just me speculating, having like never actually left my house before.
I will respond very quickly just to say that the most popular local bakery chain in Boston is called Tate, which is Israeli and owned by an Israeli woman. And there have been some efforts by students at various universities here to boycott it. But every time I go, it's always very crowded. So, I mean, I think also, and this probably, Avi, relates to what you're going to say next. I think even though things are bad, it is also to remember that we are all chronically online, and that's not true of everyone living their lives and looking to have an Israeli pastry with their coffee.
It's exactly what I was going to say, but in a very different sort of way. So there was a podcast episode recently of Decoder Ring. I don't know if you guys listen to Decoder Ring.
Yeah.
It's one of the Slate podcasts that takes a cultural mystery, as they say, and then they unpack it. And this episode, which was like 2 or 3 weeks ago, was about why all coffee shops look the same around the world, right? The white subway tile and the plants and the letterboard with the menu on it. And basically it's because of Instagram, because an independent coffee shop wants to open up in Lucerne or in Brazil, they go to Instagram to see what other coffee shops look like, and then they just make it look like that. And then there's become this like standard. So it's because of the internet that all coffee shops around the world serve the same thing, look the same way. But last week I was at an indie coffee shop, and I sent a picture that I sent to Phoebe. Do you want to describe what I sent you based on what you were talking about?
Oh, right. I have to say, because I'm not a rabbi.
I can say it. I
wasn't
no problem.
It something like Free Palestine, yay tits or something?
No,
I don't remember. I don't remember what it was. It was combining all the discourse. Yeah. They are not online enough. They are not online enough, because if they were, they would have read all of the think pieces about how appreciation of breasts is actually anti-woke. But yeah, no, I mean, this is just what I was getting at about the blue and red America thing was just the way that, what does it mean if being opposed to anti-Semitism becomes right-wing coded, and that's complicated for Jews who are by and large not right-wing.
There was an article that was exactly what you were saying, Gabby, in the New York Jewish Week, which means by extension it was in the JTA and it went everywhere, where Deborah Lipstadt gave a talk at Central Synagogue, and the headline was, Deborah Lipstadt urges New York Jews to bring the joy of Judaism despite increased anti-Semitism. And remember, she is the ambassador for anti-Semitism, and her message was that being Jewish is not something you do defensively. We have to be as much propelled by the pulls as we are enraged by the pushes. And I think that, there are so many things that we can and should be doing to celebrate Jewishness, Judaism, however we're going to define it for ourselves individually, that we have stopped focusing on. And this is not a plea for like Eish HaTorah, become more religious sort of, you know, something.
It is.
It really isn't. but we need to find those spaces and those moments, and we need to be covering those stories more and telling people, hey guys, right, there is great Jewish, you know, this. You should be doing that as a Jew. Go ahead, be yourself as a Jew. Yeah, I'm going to stop.
I'll just point out, it's a little ironic that if listeners of the show want to get to the upbeat part, they have to sit through all of our conversation about the protests and anti-Semitism.
Well, I'll make sure to put in at the header that there is a lot of upbeat stuff coming up.
Well, I just think, I'm sorry, but can we just pause for a second on the fact on what Deborah Lipstadt's actual role is? Like that it, I mean, she is literally like her job is about not Jews, but anti-Semitism. I mean, I think that is just like that. Is it not all there? You know,
she is someone who has had lots of experience with really horrible people who do not want anyone to be Jewish at all. But I think that the sentiment is exactly right. And I've seen this among friends and family for myself as well, that there is this increased appetite right now for Judaism and being Jewish and being in Jewish communities, and friends hosting Shabbat dinners who had never done that before or wanting to come to mine in a way that hadn't interested them in the past. And people just choosing to engage, to show up, to, you know, wear the Star of David, which I really feel like I see all the time now in a way that I never did. And it's a harder story to cover as a journalist. And I think about that a lot because I'm guilty in a sense of covering the bad news, and you know, journalism has that bias.
I mean, I'm gonna maybe like split the difference a little here, going a little bit zoomed out in history. What I remember learning about was that, yeah, anti-Semitism is really, it is the common ground for Jews and for people who don't even understand themselves to be Jews. That is the biggest common ground, which shouldn't be what's like cynically used as a rallying device to get Jews to be more excited about being Jewish. But as a practical matter, it is something that alerts a lot of Jews to their Jewish identity, and things flow from there, and they flow in all different kinds of directions. Sometimes people are Theodor Herzl and they go in one direction. But it can go any which way, and it doesn't necessarily have to do with Israel, doesn't necessarily not have to do with Israel. I think it could be somebody could get really into Israeli pop music. But I guess what I'm saying is I don't think that covering anti-Semitism is separate. Like the first step to caring that you're Jewish is knowing that you're Jewish. And unfortunately, that is how a lot of people kind of come to more saliently understand that they're Jewish.
So here's my hot take that I've been formulating over just the past few minutes.
Okay.
I always used to, was like, one of the things I used to say when I was having this type of discourse, because it's not the first time I've mentioned this, is, oh my God, like if you look at other cultures that were historically marginalized and hated, one of the things that they did when they were pushing back against the hate in the late 20, early 21st century was to really not lean on the fact, stop hating us. It was, we have so much great culture. Right? We have drag shows. We have gay people in movies. We have movies that don't involve just, you know, token gay characters. This is what we do. We have African American music. We have this. We have that. And yet, if we tried, I suspect that one of the reasons why that's not happening as much is that if we tried to do that, it would be yet another sign that Jews run Hollywood or Jews run the media. And so it's like, hey, let's not talk about all the Jews that are showing up in movies right now, even though it might make us feel good about things.
I don't think that people in the Jewish community necessarily need to reach for the representation. It's not perfect, but there are lots of Jews in those spaces. But I think it's more people turning inward, which maybe isn't always a good thing, but it's the Jewish communities that are growing, and you know, we are not a proselytizing people, even though being Jewish is great. And so we're not out there saying like, come join us. I'll just give as an example. Last week, the Chabad at Harvard brought in Yishai Ribo, this Israeli musician, to do a concert on campus, just in light of all of the Harvard craziness. And it was at a concert venue in Cambridge. And it turned out that a bunch of workers there weren't going to show up. They didn't want to work the concert. They didn't want to, you know, support genocide, as they said. And so to walk into this show, you had to go past lots of protesters who were outside for hours in the freezing rain. And then when you got in, it was the warmest environment. People were so happy to be there. Israeli flags, people singing along, the whole range of Jewish life from secular to Orthodox. But it was, you know, I would guess there weren't really people there who weren't Jewish. And it was heavily guarded and sort of fortified. And I think that describes so much of what life is to be Jewish right now. It's not necessarily offering our culture to others, even though, you know, there are always efforts to bring people in and make our Shabbat tables welcoming. But it's really to be a place for us and for people to feel like part of a community. And to get there, you might have to walk past a bunch of people screaming at you and accusing you of genocide. But once you make it in the door, which might have some heavily armed policemen outside, you can have a great time being Jewish.
You are actually kind of at the center of things with all of, there's so much news about Harvard. Like, I have nothing to do with Harvard. I feel like I know everything about Harvard. I know what, like, what's every square foot of Harvard it looks like or something at this point from the media. And I was going to ask you, is it really like that? You know, is it really on a day-to-day basis as one would imagine from the media? But I feel like you kind of just answered what it's really like. And it's a complicated answer, but yeah.
As a journalist, I sort of struggle with the question of there's hundreds or thousands of universities. Why do we pay so much attention to Harvard? Is it that things there are really so much worse? Is it, you know, Harvard's the best known educational brand in the world, so they deserve special attention? For me, it's also proximity. But that being said, I do think Harvard has been in this downward spiral, if you will, since that letter came out on October 8th from those student groups, and they have just been in reaction mode and defensive mode ever since. And I think there's a lot of Jewish students at Harvard, less than there were probably 10 years ago, which might factor into things. But there are a lot of Jewish students, and there's great Jewish programming on campus. But there also are a lot of students who I think don't feel safe. Or I think something that's come out for a lot of people is, even if it's not a question of physical safety, it's like this question of belonging. And so there's someone I know at the law school here who is an observant Jew. He wears a kippah. And he told me that one time he had been just chatting in kind of the central campus building with a friend. And then afterward, he walked away. And a third person walked up to that friend and said, "I wanted to come say hi to you, but I didn't want to be seen with this person in a kippah." And so it's things like that where I think that you hear those stories a lot, or people who don't want to post on social media anything having to do with Israel or being Jewish because they're worried that they will be shunned by their peers or it will have repercussions for their career. You know, thank God, I guess, that it hasn't turned to violence. But the way that I and I think a lot of others have been thinking about these questions in recent months is, you know, is it important for Jews to feel comfortable at a place like Harvard or any other university? I think the answer is yes. And they just, a lot of them just very much do not lately.
Well, let's try to end it on a good note. Let's move on to Nachas right after we hear from our sponsor.
Are you in the market for a new watch or a special piece of jewelry? Are you looking for the perfect engagement ring to pop the question? Atelier Lou has all this and more. Eric and the team at Atelier Lou can craft a piece for you, or you can select from some of the exclusive designers that they offer. From a simple bangle to a statement necklace, Atelier Lou can make you or your loved ones sparkle. Located in the heart of Westmount in Montreal or online at atelierlou.com, visit Atelier Lou for your next watch or jewelry purchase. And when you do, make sure to use promo code BON18 for 10% off your next purchase. That's atelierlou.com.
as we said earlier in the show, there's a lot of good to think about when it comes to Judaism and what one's Jewishness is and can be. Gabby, do you have any nachas for us this week?
I am actually going to go back to Houston. I ate at another Jewish restaurant there. I went to Kenny and Ziggy's, which is a famous Jewish deli there. And I was checking out and buying some baked goods and standing at the display case with the black and white cookies and all of the classic Jewish deli treats. Well, this woman came up to me while I was standing there, and she clearly was not Jewish because she asked me, "Have you ever had any of these before?" Like, she had never seen a black and white cookie before. And so I basically went through a description, you know, ranking every kind of deli cookie and baked good. And she was so grateful. She left with black and white cookies. She was very excited to try something new. So even though we don't proselytize, I think I did my part in spreading the good Jewish word this week.
Do you know the secret to why a black and white cookie is so different and people love them?
No. I don't, and I have been wondering.
It's actually cake batter. It's not a cookie batter.
That makes sense. Yes.
I see it. Thank you.
Phoebe, what's your nachas this week?
Oh, I'm very excited about it. So it's the obituary for Julie Lynn Charlotte, creator of the poodle skirt, who recently died at 101 years old. It's an obituary in the New York Times by Marguerite Fox. And the opening, the lead, okay, of this just struck me. Okay. What's a nice Jewish viscountess to do when she has a title but no money, a party invitation but no clothes, and a pair of scissors but no sewing skills? Invent the poodle skirt, of course. So this is this fabulous story about the invention of the poodle skirt and this amazing woman who invented the poodle skirt, who, another quote from the obituary, she married four times, quote, to two millionaires, a royal count, and a son of a, and here she paused for dramatic effect, baron. So I really like that. But also then there's a Canadian tie-in.
The Labrador skirt.
Yeah, right. Well, no, but it's obvious. You're scooping it with something that's actually better than your joke, which is that... Oh. Sorry, I know I hate to say this. But so it's about that the poodle skirt had kind of gone out of fashion in the 60s. And then another quote from the obituary. But before that happened, a young woman was captured in a press photograph that betrayed the reach of Ms. Charlotte's work. The time was 1951, and the place was Ottawa, where the woman was attending a hoedown at the home of Canada's Governor General. At 25, she'd never seen a hoedown, blah, blah. Okay, so the woman, her name was Elizabeth Alexandra Mary Windsor, and she would be known from the next year on as Queen Elizabeth II. There's a picture of Queen Elizabeth in her poodle skirt in Ottawa, dancing before she was Queen Elizabeth. I loved every single thing about this article. I mean, I'm sorry she died. That's sad. She should have been immortal, but 101 is a good life. The tidbit that I want to share from this that I had not known is that the poodle skirt was supposed to be a dachshund skirt, but poodles were more in fashion, so she had to make it then with poodles. But there's a picture of the original dachshund skirt linked from the New York Times obituary. So, that was my Canadian Jewish nachas that I'm never going to match again.
I'll just add one more Jewish angle to the poodle skirt story, which is that I had a friend in middle school and her bat mitzvah was like 1950s themed and we all had to wear poodle skirts.
That is epic. I have one more Jewish thing for this.
Please.
Would a poodle skirt be considered modest enough in like modern Orthodox? Probably, or no.
It depends who you ask, because there are people that will say it covers the knees and that's not a problem. Okay. And then there are people that will be like, well, when you twirl and you flare out, everything can be seen. So that's I'd like to see the ankle-length poodle skirt that will like really make you launch if you really like get it.
You need a standard poodle for that one. Yes. A mini poodle would be definitely not a toy. Definitely not a teacup.
I hear.
Okay. Avi, what have you got?
I am going to go back to the world of Ashkenazi food. There was a wonderful and wonderfully written, and that's really the reason why I want to call it out, Ode to Cholent in Longreads this week by Benjamin Dubow. The Sabbath stew, what started as a loophole, has remained one of Judaism's most evocative, redolent foods. It will take you almost as long to read it as it does to cook it. But there have been many, many odes to Cholent, many, many histories of Cholent. This is how much Cholent lives in the Ashkenazi imagination as this amazingly powerful.
So can I ask you an important question, though, about this?
Yeah.
I'm Ashkenazi, 100% Ashkenazi. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what Cholent is. I've heard the name before. Like, I've never tasted it. I've never encountered this.
So part of this...
Do you have to be a Sabbath, a very strictly Sabbath-observing Jew to eat Cholent?
You don't have to be, but it exists primarily because of the Sabbath. So Cholent goes way back. I always say that there's really only two Jewish foods, and that's matzah and Cholent. Matzah because it's biblically mandated in the way in which it's supposed to be made, and Cholent because of the way in which it is cooked. And you're not allowed to cook anything on Shabbat, but if you want to eat something hot the next day, you have to cook a stew. Because you needed to cook it overnight, it became like the standard food to eat on Shabbat, and as a result became a very, very Jewish thing to have and to eat. You can make Cholent on a Tuesday night and serve it on a Wednesday.
I was going to say, with the Texas connection, it almost seems like it could be like a chili Cholent. You could kind of...
Phoebe, next time I'm in Toronto, I will make you a proper Cholent.
Where? Where would that even happen?
I'll make it in your kitchen. We'll make it work, yeah. We should make the poster, like the bagels, right? You don't have to be Shomer Shabbat to enjoy Cholent. Gabby, this has been wonderful. Thanks so much for being part of this today, and really come back anytime.
Thank you. This was so much fun, and glad to be part of the Frozen Chosen briefly.
Thank you for listening to Bonjour Chai for the week ending March 9th, Shabbat Parashat Vayakhel. The show is produced by Michael Freeman and edited by Zach Kaufman. The executive producer for CJN Podcasts is Michael Freeman. Our music is by So-Called. We are a project of the Jewish Living Lab and are distributed by the CJN Podcast Network. You can listen to all our past episodes on our page at thecjn.ca/bonjour, and you can subscribe to the podcast and automatically receive all episodes on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please do tell a friend about Bonjour Chai. We love knowing that people are talking about us. And as always, you can email us with comments at bonjour@thecjn.ca.